Welcome to another edition of the New Hampshire Journal podcast. I am Michael Graham. Thank you so much for joining us. With me, the star of the show from the Josiah Bartlett Center for Public Policy, Mr. Drew Klein. How are you, sir?
Pretty good. How are you doing?
You're the hardest working man in think tank business. That's what I've decided.
I doubt that.
I don't doubt it at all. Although you did recently take a trip down south. I'm getting ready to take a trip down south. And what I love is the weather, apparently, I was looking at the computer, is going to be identical in New Hampshire and South Carolina. It's going to be like 89 when I leave here and 89 when I get there.
I just want sunshine. That's all I need right now is sunshine. I'm starting to get a little like Jack Nicholson in The Shining because of all the clouds and rain. It's getting disturbing.
All I got to say is, as a guy who grew up in South Carolina, wearing a jacket in August is just an astonishing experience that I still can't get used to. Something else I can't get used to, Drew Klein, is the president of the United States standing up and saying, yeah, I'm doing something that's illegal, but a lot of people really want me to do it, so I'm just going to keep doing it. And, of course, I'm talking about the eviction moratorium, which was illegally put in place by the Trump administration. It was maintained by the Supreme Court only because the court said, well, it's going to expire August 1st anyway, so we could end it, but, you know, we'll just let it end August 1st and cause, you know, to give Congress time to act, to give people a chance to do things by the rules. And of course, Congress didn't act. And here we are. And the president says, I'm doing it anyway. And Governor Chris Sununu keeps saying New Hampshire doesn't need an eviction moratorium because we have literally tens of millions of dollars for people who can't pay their rent. And unemployment is below 3%, and he's being called a hater. I mean, you got to admit, Drew, it's pretty amazing when someone says something like, you know, you need to pay your rent. And people go, oh my gosh, what kind of hater are you?
I think the question for those who are, a couple of questions for those who are pushing an expansion of the obviously already unconstitutional and illegal eviction moratorium is—
Can I stop you right there? Could you explain to everybody why this is so illegal?
Well, it wasn't passed by Congress.
Wait. So I want to make sure I understand your radical position here, Drew Klein. You're saying that an arbitrary government agency like the CDC, which, by the way, has nothing to do with housing, can't just stand up and go, I order you. You cannot evict people if they refuse to pay their rent. You're saying so. You're telling me that the FDA can't declare it illegal for people to show adult films. That's what you're saying. You just can't do this.
Correct. I think James Madison has been spinning ever more vigorously in his grave for the last several years. And if you see a fire break out at Montpelier in the grounds, I think you'll know why. It's all the friction from him spinning. No, you can't do it. It's plainly unconstitutional. And the extension that Joe Biden has acknowledged he doesn't have a legal authority to do, but has said, well, I've found a couple of lawyers who I've convinced to say that it's constitutional, so therefore we're going to do it anyway.
I keep interrupting, but I just, yeah. On Thursday afternoon, he told a reporter, I think we can keep this alive by appealing in court for at least a month. So he's saying explicitly, I know this is illegal, exactly. But I can drag it out in court and keep breaking the law.
Right. So let's be clear. I mean, DACA, you know, when this is, I'm getting really sick of presidents doing this, right? So Obama said, you know, I don't have the authority to pass this stuff for immigration, the DREAM Act and all that under executive orders. It has to be passed by Congress. When Congress didn't do it, he said he just did it anyway. He had already acknowledged he didn't have the authority to do it. That's unconstitutional. You know, we don't want to get into, I mean, how many Trump executive orders were unconstitutional, probably. And you have Biden acknowledging, saying that, admitting it's unconstitutional and then doing it. And by the way, just so we're clear, if you as president acknowledge that you know what you're doing is unconstitutional and then you do it anyway, that is an automatic impeachable offense. Now, I'm not saying Biden should be impeached, that Congress should do that, but it's just like the lowest bar for an unimpeachable offense to say, you know what, I'm just going to announce that I'm violating the Constitution and I'm going to do it anyway. That's just automatic. Like, that's just the lowest level on the
I talked to two legal scholars, and they tell me that you're wrong, that you only impeach people for offenses that involve phone calls to the Ukraine. So you're completely wrong. But anyway,
well, I mean, phone calls to the Ukraine or indiscretions, you know, in the Oval Office. I mean, those are, yeah, you got to widen it a little bit. But but basically, like, you can't do it. And Biden's acknowledging that what he's hoping for is to extend the moratorium a little bit longer as the case winds through, because it'll automatically be challenged. And then the legal case will wind through the courts. And in that window of time, before they get a ruling where the judges unanimously declare that it's unconstitutional, he'll buy a little more eviction moratorium. But the question is, why? Why are they pushing this eviction moratorium? At what point, and this is my question too, that I alluded to earlier, for President Biden, all the politicians who support the existing moratorium and expanding it, the question that they ought to be asked that I haven't seen any reporters ask them during press conferences is, what should, put it this way, where's the line on when somebody can or cannot be evicted? Do you support property owners being able at all under some circumstances to evict somebody? Are there circumstances under which a landlord should be allowed to evict? Right? Let's just ask that basic question. I suspect you would find a lot of politicians who would not want to answer that question, because ultimately they really believe that you actually don't have any rights to the property you own. And that as soon as somebody moves in and you lease it to them, forget the contract, forget that there's a lease, it's legally binding. Once you provide somebody a home, that person has squatter's rights indefinitely to that. I think that's where a lot of politicians are at this point. And I think that's really alarming. And I'll give you an example. Our counterpart in Connecticut, Yankee Institute, the other free market think tank down there, has done some really good reporting on the effects of the eviction moratorium. And you can find their reporting at yankeeinstitute.org, I think is their address. They reported on a case where a guy had started before the pandemic to try to evict a tenant. The eviction moratorium went in, and it took him months and months and months to evict this guy who stopped paying rent. So he just decided he wasn't going to pay rent anymore because he was mad at his landlord for the landlord enforcing the terms of the lease. And it cost the landlord something like $40,000 to evict one guy from one unit because the eviction moratorium was in place. So he wasn't getting any rent from this guy. The guy trashed the apartment, spray painted it, destroyed the appliances, and still couldn't evict him because there was this crazy eviction moratorium in place. So
I want to get to why an eviction moratorium is bad, and you know, because you know why, but there may be some people who haven't kind of put these pieces together. But just a couple of things to put out. There are repeated stories. The Wall Street Journal's had them. Even the New York Times has admitted that it's happened. Fox News, of people who are using the eviction moratorium to prevent paying rent, yeah, who are subletting the unit that they're not paying rent on. So they are literally making money off the union. Yeah, they're the one. And you got to pay
but
them.
The question is, right, but the question is, can they evict their sublet? Right,
exactly. Well, of course not. That's what they got to work this around. But that's
I think they think they can.
Yeah, but here's my point is that we know for a fact that there are people who can pay their rent and should pay their rent who just aren't. And one reason we know this for a fact is that unemployment is 3%. Another reason we know is that, you know, average household income went up last year. And so the premise of we need this emergency eviction moratorium because we're in an emergency, that may have been true 12 months ago. It may have been true 6 months ago, you could argue. But there is no evidence that it's true now. So I want to ask you to explain to, you know, people who don't follow economics, why it is terrible for people who want there to be housing, for terrible for the people who are complaining right now that New Hampshire's rents are too high and it's too hard to find housing. Why a permanent eviction moratorium, which is what representatives AOC, Cori Bush, et cetera, what they want, They want a permanent moratorium eviction, eviction moratorium. Why that would be a disaster for people who care about, for example, low cost housing.
Sure. Well, I mean, there's lots of reasons why it's bad, but let's just get to the most basic one is that if you prevent landlords from ever being able to evict the tenant for whatever reason, then you will have no more apartments being built. Nobody in their right mind is going to build apartment buildings or duplexes or buy a duplex for rental property and then lease it out if they know there's no circumstance under which they can kick out a tenant. So, you know, you want to create systems that encourage the building of more rental units. And we have in New Hampshire, so the eviction moratorium just basically discourages opening your property for rent. It actually is, if it were, the longer it stays in place, the less likely you will have new people getting into the business of leasing property and people who are already in the business opening up and investing in more rental properties. So it's going to, over time, diminish the number of rental units, which is already artificially low because we have gazillion local regulations on land use and planning that basically outlaw apartments in large portions of most communities in New Hampshire. So you've already got a massive shortage of rental housing that's caused by local regulations and NIMBYism and people not wanting to have those that they perceive being lower income than themselves renting in their communities. And then you throw an eviction moratorium on top of it, you're just going to get fewer and fewer apartments.
You know, I think one of the things that people who don't think about economics, and I certainly don't ever think about is the comparative value of investments, of what you can do with your money. You know, you can, you got your retirement savings. You can put in the stock market and get whatever, 4%, 5%, 6%, whatever percent, or you can do something else. And so if you want people to invest money in housing, so there's lots of housing, the price comes down, it's available, they have to not just be able to pay the bills, they have to be able to make a return that can compete with the other stuff they can do. Because who the heck wants to fight with tenants who are, you know, ripping the plumbing out of the floors and doing whatever they're doing to try to get your money back? You're like, forget it. I'll just put the money in the stock market and then I won't think about it again. And so that's one of the challenges that people just don't. They think hating on landlords is easy and that everyone hates landlords. But you know what people really hate? They hate deadbeats. They hate the idea that you're going to get an apartment and not pay your bills. This is the same thing that goes back to the Tea Party movement. People thought the Tea Party movement was about, I know this is going to shock you, Drew, but in 2009, spending $1 trillion, just $1 trillion, was considered shocking. And it shocked the moral sense of America. But the Tea Party was really about the notion that you bought a house, you entered a mortgage, you took a deal, the deal didn't work out, and now you just want out. I just want to live in the house and not pay for it. And because even in the darkest days of the economic collapse, more than 90% of Americans were still paying their mortgages, their attitude was, hey, I pay my mortgage, you need to pay yours. You need to work something out. It's your job to pay your bills. And I think the AOC end of the Democratic Party is getting the politics of this completely wrong. And I think that when the New Hampshire Democrats chose to attack Sununu on this, I was thinking, what are you thinking now?
What are they thinking? It's really remarkable.
I don't get it.
Well, it's just like attacking him on the tax cuts, you know. Yeah, I mean, exactly. So this is how, like, so the New Hampshire Democratic Party has consistently attacked Sununu and Republicans on tax cuts, on business tax rate cuts, by claiming that those cuts exclusively benefit large out-of-state corporations. So you'll see this in their press releases. He's cutting taxes for large out-of-state corporations. Well, we have a flat business tax rate that applies to everyone in New Hampshire, every business. So if you have a business that qualifies to pay taxes, whether you're a mom and pop shop or Target or Walmart, you pay the same tax rate. So it applies to everybody. Well, the eviction moratorium is similar. You will hear people present this as hurting big business, you know, large corporations, these big developers. Well, the Pew Research just recently, a couple of days ago, released a study of landlords. The number of units owned by businesses, rental units owned by businesses in the US, 3.4 million. This is number of landlords by units owned, 3.4 million. Number of individual investors, 14.1 million. Yep. So there are vastly more, the vast majority of landlords in this country are small individual investors who right. bought the property to make a little bit of cash as an investment.
We've got a great conversation coming up with a very special guest. So I want to move us along. You make a great point. I just want to add that attacking Sununu on the eviction moratorium, attacking on taxes, those are all done, but nothing was as close as sending out a press release this week. Governor Sununu signed the law protecting the live free or die motto. He also protected In God We Trust. We're out. I mean, I don't, I'm from South Carolina, Lee Atwater's home state. He must be laughing his butt off in the pits of hell as he watches. So let me get this straight. You're sending out a press release to make sure everyone knows that you hate the state's motto, live free or die, and don't think schools should be able to just put it up. You want to be anti In God We Trust. They're doing this on purpose. I'm setting aside who's right and who's wrong. I'm setting aside political ideology. Just from a guy who likes politics the same way most people like football, this is some of the worst play calling I've ever seen in my life. So I had to just mention that. We write about it at nhjournal.com. And of course, if you get our newsletter, you would know about this because our newsletter arrives in your email box. It's Monday, Wednesday, Friday for our summer solstice. We'll be picking it back up. And just a programming note, next week, starting August 9th, there'll be nothing because we're going dark. I'm going to take a much needed break for a week. So one of my other pet topics, Drew Klein, and you know this, is I've always been anti-zero tolerance policies. Zero tolerance equals 100% stupidity. You see it with COVID, where these people are saying we're going to have zero COVID. You're never going to have zero COVID. So stop playing for zero, play for mitigation, play for making things as good as they can be, knowing that some problems aren't solvable. And that issue is popping up because one of the plans to help pay for not the bipartisan $1.2 trillion infrastructure bill, but the purely partisan $3.5 trillion on top of it bill they plan to do with human infrastructure, whatever that means. One of the ways they're going to pay for it is with this tax called the tobacco equity tax. And so it's a big product of Senator Dick Durbin. And what it would do is it would double the tobacco tax on cigarettes. And then this is the part that's troublesome. It would then tax everything else and get it to parity equal to this new doubled tax. So the cigarette taxes is going to go from about $1 a pack for just the federal tax to $2, but it's going to include cigars. I'm a cigar guy. I'm very annoyed, but that, whatever, man, that's just me personally. It's going to include, it's 1,000% increase in the tax on pipe tobacco. Who cares? There's 9 people smoking pipes. They're going to put this tax, Drew, on e-cigarettes and snus and IQOS and the other non-harmful, very low harm nicotine alternatives. In other words, the things that if we could get more people to shift to them, we would see deaths and health issues collapse, because by the FDA has even acknowledged that snus and IQOS are 95% less harmful than traditional combustible cigarettes. And well, yet the plan is clear to make them as expensive as regular cigarettes, taking away one of the incentives for people to say, you know what, I'm not paying $12 a pack for cigarettes anymore. I'm going to try this vape thing. I'm going to try this whatever thing they try. I don't care. I just want them to stop smoking cigarettes so they'll be healthier, even if they are doing something that, you know, isn't as healthy as jogging and breathing clean, fresh air. That's my rant. It's so stupid to try to punish people for doing something that's 95% safer than the thing that they're going to do if you don't let them or encourage them to switch to the other thing.
Right. And Durbin calls this the Tobacco Equity Act. To be clear, e-cigarettes contain no tobacco. Exactly. So they contain nicotine. And the reason they contain nicotine is because that's the addictive product in tobacco. That's what gives you the high. That's what people come back for. And e-cigarettes give you a way to get the nicotine without getting the tar and the tobacco that causes cancer. Nicotine does not cause cancer. So nicotine, the e-cigarettes have been proven in multiple studies to be a vastly safer alternative to cigarettes. They are recommended in the UK by a lot of public health professionals as a smoking cessation tool, there have been quite a few studies that found them effective as a smoking cessation tool. So he's calling it the Tobacco Equity Act tax, but he is taxing products that contain no tobacco that are specifically useful and helpful in getting people to quit using tobacco products. So that's tip number one, that this is not remotely about smoking cessation. It is about revenue. His press release that he put out, I found offensive, hilarious if it wasn't offensive. So he goes on and on about how much he cares about children smoking and how this act is going to raise the price of cigarettes so high that kids won't start smoking. But of course, it's going to raise the price of e-cigarettes vastly as well, which is the thing that they're going to transition to. But it also includes lots of stuff that kids don't smoke, like pipes. So you're going to dramatically raise the tax on pipe tobacco? Like, there's a bunch of kids in their smoking jackets in the playground after school smoking pipes.
It's wait.
Crazy.
Are you saying that was just me?
That was just you.
That was just me behind the school with my smoking jacket and my cravat and my pipe. Yeah. I was the only one. How about premium cigars? And you and I are cigars. Big fans. We are big fans of Castro's. Big fans Castro's of Twins.
And Twins, our favorite haunts of ours. And the premium cigars, so look, New Hampshire does not have a tax on premium cigars. New Hampshire excludes premium cigars from its tobacco tax. Florida and several other states do as well. One of the reasons behind that is because you do not inhale cigar smoke. So tobacco taxes were originally conceived as a sin tax. So, you know, it's bad for you, it's unhealthy, you're gonna get cancer and all that. Yeah, you can get mouth cancer from tobacco smoke, but it's much less likely than cigarettes. They're safer than cigarettes, et cetera, et cetera. So they're classified differently than cigarettes by a lot of states, but the federal government taxes them. This particular bill would make them quite a bit more expensive. Like per cigar, this particular legislation, depending on the size, so it raises the tax by weight.
Yeah.
So
it's a weird system. A federal tax based on price.
Yeah.
At the wholesale level. Now they're going to go to a weight tax. So it's hard to translate.
Which means if you, those big Churchill cigars that, you know, you're going to pay more, a lot more for those giant cigars. But it could raise the price per cigar on the small cigars by like $1.50 in states like Florida and New Hampshire that don't have their own taxes. Right. And because those taxes are set sometimes based on the price of the cigar. And so it's going to go up. So in some states, like you could be, you know, have a $253, $4 tax.
Right. Yeah, our calculation, we have a piece about this. Yeah, we have a piece about this in H Journal, and the best calculation I was able to find was it's going to be about a 25% hike in states that don't have other than other tobacco products tax that you're just talking about. But I just want to make a point. You talk about kids. I found out that the average person's first cigar happens when they're 30 years old. That's the average. So I'm kind of surprised. But that's all that is to me. You know, it's fascinating. It's interesting. It skips the big point, which is using financial incentives to try to make things better. You know, you see this fight with COVID, where there are people who are just anxious to go to a lockdown. They just want to go right back to the lockdown. Well, you're just not, it's not going to happen. You can argue that we should, that we, the American people are not going to lock down. So what can you do to be smarter, to make things better, as opposed to basically making people mad and then failing because you're never going to get to zero? Smokers, you are going to have smokers. The percentage of the adult population that smokes is down to 14%. That's a huge drop from when my mom and dad were young, and they both smoked when they were like, you know, in their 20s, because everybody smoked. And then they stopped when they were in like their 40s and they've never smoked since. And you know, that's a trajectory. The attempt to get to zero is going to be a fiasco. And meanwhile, there are thousands, hundreds of thousands in the United States of people who would transition away from cigarettes if they had the right incentives and if they were getting the right message. But instead the message is, no, you must do nothing. Well, they're not going to do nothing. That's just what's going to happen. And here's what's fascinating, Drew. This is part of that, partisan budget reconciliation bill. They're going to need all 50 U.S. senators. Is Senator Hassan, on the eve of an election, going to look out at New Hampshire, at its thriving cigar bar culture? Is he going to look out at the revenue? New Hampshire wins right now. from a tobacco revenue standpoint because of the high taxes of the states around us. We will lose an estimated $13.5 million a year if this goes through because of declining sales. Is she going to look at the people of New Hampshire and who need to, you know, give up the Marlboros and go to a E whatever and vote not just to raise $3.5 trillion in spending, but also to damage these people, these businesses, state revenue, et cetera? That's a very interesting question for me for 2021, 22.
Well, so I'm going to write about this at some point, but I did some research on the cigar bar industry in New Hampshire a few years ago. And one of the most fascinating findings about it is that our cigar bars in New Hampshire are a direct outgrowth of Massachusetts tobacco tax.
Absolutely.
Mass applied tax, tobacco tax to cigars, raised it. And then, you know, basically banned smoking everywhere. And so, 20 some years ago, Boston had a lot of cigar bars. Boston was down to one. Stanzi's it. And people who had cigar shops in Boston and in some other Massachusetts towns moved them to New Hampshire. Several of our cigar bars were started by Massachusetts folks moving over here. And then we had this culture that grew out of basically tax refugees. So that's interesting. But I think one of the ways you can tell that this whole thing is a lie is because to go back to Durbin's press release announcing this earlier this year, it's all about preventing kids from smoking and all about, you know, the public health good we're going to do. But you can see when he's taxing, you know, premium cigars and e-cigarettes, which have no tobacco in them and are a smoking cessation tool, that it's really just about raising revenue. And that's one of the things that I think annoys a lot of Americans is when a politician is really just doing a revenue grab, but claims it's for a higher purpose, because they can't just say, yeah, we're just going to tax. We just think we can get away with taxing these products.
Well, you and I have talked about it, but the guy who's the expert, particularly on the tax side, is Ulrich Boesen with the Tax Foundation. And he joins us here on the New Hampshire Journal podcast. So welcome to the podcast, Ulrich Boesen. He's with the Tax Foundation. We've actually done some events together on the issue of smoking, tobacco, non-traditional products. You know, is it better to try to ban all tobacco, cigarettes, and nicotine, or is it better to get people who are going to use them to use something that causes less harm? The word they use is mitigation. I'm going to mitigate this fiasco of a podcast by turning it over to Ulrich as soon as possible. Thanks for your time.
Thank you for having me.
So I want to ask you specifically about this proposal from Senator Dick Durbin of Illinois that's been around for a while, the Tobacco Tax Equity Act. And according to sources, it could play a role in the upcoming budget dance. First of all, what is the Tobacco Tax Equity Act? And Ulrich, isn't it always a good thing just to tax the snot out of tobacco? After all, we all hate smokers, right?
Well, it is. The bill, as you said, has been around for a while. So what the bill would do is that it would double the tax rate that's currently levied on cigarettes, which is levied at $50.33 per thousand. That comes out to a dollar roughly per pack. So that would be doubled to $100 per thousand or $2 per pack. Now, all other categories of tobacco, and that's where the equity part of the title comes in, would be taxed at levels equal to cigarettes. You alluded to it in your introduction. Is it better to just tax tobacco as much as you can, or is it better to try and help current smokers find less harmful products? One of the ways you do that is by taxing less harmful products at lower rates than cigarettes, which is generally understood to be the most dangerous way to consume nicotine. So you have snus products out there, for instance, and this Equity Act would increase the taxes on these products to equal rates with cigarettes, which would obviously impact prices of these products quite significantly, and take away incentive for smokers to substitute the products. So that, you know, is a surprising part of this plan. The plan would also institute a vapor products tax, which would be the first federal tax on vapor products. Now, it doesn't state the exact rate. It asks the Department of Treasury to come up with a rate, to come up with a way to tax it. It only stipulates that it should be taxed at a rate which is equal to the rate of tobacco. or to the rate of cigarettes. Now, they're very hard to compare directly to cigarettes. You know, vapor products are liquid, cigarettes are sticks. So it'll be interesting to see what the Treasury Department comes up with for taxation of vapor products. So that's the bill. Whether it's just good to tax people who smoke a lot, I would question that. We know that there are obviously negative impact for smoking. You know, we highly encourage anyone who smokes to quit immediately. But you can't just tax without negative consequences. You know, every piece of tax legislation is a question of trade-offs.
Well, let's talk a little bit more specifically about those other taxes that are in there. I am an occasional cigar smoker. And my understanding is that this bill would completely change how your, if you go down and have the occasion, I'm a Padron guy. Just if anyone's buying, Padron Anniversarios are very nice. But if you go down and get an Ashton or whatever, it's going to fundamentally change how that's taxed. And also for pipe smokers and other tobacco users as well, right?
That is accurate. So for large cigars, which is, you know, the traditional cigar that people know as a cigar, that's currently taxed based on the price. That'll be changed to be taxed based on weight. Now, obviously, that means it's very hard to compare the current situation to how right. the taxes will be in the future.
I've never weighed a cigar. I have to be honest with you.
Exactly. So that'll be, you know, on an individual basis, depending on what your cigar cost today, maybe it'll be taxed at a higher rate or lower rate. That's really hard to say. For pipe tobacco, that's interesting. That is a very significant increase. So currently, pipe tobacco is taxed at $2.8 per pound. That rate will increase to $49.56 per pound. That's an increase of over 1,650%.
Wow.
And that's because they're trying to bring it up to the level of cigarettes. And traditionally, pipe tobacco, which is a much smaller market, the cigarette market, has been taxed at lower rates. You know, so that's some of the impacts you get when you just demand parity across all categories.
And this is my point, is that if you say to somebody, someone you love is going to smoke, they're either going to be a traditional cigarette smoker, which usually means habitual smoking a pack or two a day, or they're going to be an occasional cigar or pipe smoker, right away people would say, well, I don't want them to smoke at all, but you definitely don't want to do the traditional combustible cigarette model. And they say, okay, well, we've even got these other things, which are everything from vapes to snus to IQOS to, whatever. And these things are 95 to 99% less harmful. I think the average person, Ulrich, would say, well, I want them to do that. So if you put it that way, people understand the idea of mitigating risk. And yet this law, in essence, says, hey, you might as well stick with the most dangerous form of tobacco because we are going to punish you across the board, whatever choice you make. Am I understanding that correctly?
That is correct. I mean, if we look at the understanding of the difference in harm from different tobacco products, the FDA has acknowledged this, right? So the FDA has basically accepted that there is a continuum of risk when you talk tobacco products. And they have a system that analyzes the risk associated with different tobacco consumption. So one of the things they do is they allow tobacco manufacturers to apply for what's called an MRTP or modified risk tobacco product. Snus, for instance, has such an MRTP designation, which means the FDA says it's less harmful than cigarettes. Now, that's relevant for tax policy because when we talk excise taxation, we normally think that the size of the tax should be connected to the size of the harm associated with consumption. And as you said, you know, habitual smoking, everyday smoking, that is the most dangerous way to consume nicotine. Now, the FDA said if you consume nicotine by using snus, it is much less harmful. Good. Then the tax should be much lower. That's the connection between harm and tax policy. And the Tobacco Tax Equity Act completely ignores this and just says all tobacco products are equal and they should be taxed as such. And I think that's a serious flaw with this proposal.
There's also something else, which is just the having a significant tax hike across the board. You wrote in the past about what happened when Massachusetts started implementing bans on certain kinds of cigarettes, flavored cigarettes, et cetera. It's not the case that people stop consuming them. It just changes where they get them from. And I thought it was interesting, Ulrich, and you may know more about this, but the folks at the Mackinac Center track the sale of illicit cigarettes, smuggled cigarettes, whatever phrase you want to use for people who aren't paying the taxes because they're so stinking high. And I had no idea, as of 2019, more than half of the cigarettes being smoked in New York State were smuggled or contraband or whatever the phrase is. And not surprisingly, New York has insanely high, you know, cigarette taxes, tobacco taxes. California's number two, same thing, and on and on. And so if you look at what happened from Massachusetts to New Hampshire, aren't we going to see a similar thing where the increase in taxes isn't going to cause people to stop smoking? It's going to cause them to say either, why bother switching to vape? I'll just stick with my, you know, Marlboro Lights, or holy crud, these things are too expensive. I'm going to start buying them when they fall off the back of a truck, you know, in my neighborhood.
No, absolutely. I think that's a good point that you would risk seeing more both casual smuggling, you know, which is when, let's say a New Yorker drives over to New Jersey and buys a pack of cigarette. That's not necessarily illegal or tax evasion. He can do that legally. But, you know, it's still no tax dollars for New York State.
By the way, I just want to point out to our listeners that about one third of the entire New Hampshire economy is based on the premise of driving across the border from New York, Massachusetts, Maine, et cetera, to buy cheaper stuff. But please go ahead.
Yeah, New Hampshire is actually, I think, the state in the nation with the highest outbound smuggling rate at almost 67%.
Live free or die, baby.
And that's not even because the tax rates are significantly lower in New Hampshire than they are nationwide. They're just surrounded by high tax states. So that offers them the opportunity to sell cigarettes to a bunch of out-of-staters. But I did look at New York specifically and see, why does this happen? Why is more than half the cigarettes smoked in New York purchased from other places? And I think the answer is fairly simple. If you make $15,000 a year and you live in New York, you're paying 16.6% of your income in tobacco taxes to smoke a pack of cigarettes a day. That's almost 17% of your income goes to tobacco taxes. No one can afford that, obviously, so they have to get their cigarettes from other sources. And we can see that across the country. People who are in those lower income groups pay so much of their income in tobacco taxes if they smoke cigarettes. And obviously, adding another dollar on top for a pack a day smoker, that's adding another $365 a year in tobacco taxes. That's something most people can't just, you know, afford if you're a lower income family. So yeah, I absolutely think that adding that much in terms of tax burdens could further increase smuggling across the country.
And I'm glad that you mentioned lower income, because, you know, so often in politics, people seem to want to talk about a world that exists only on paper, you know, in theory. But in fact, you have the data. If the lower your income, the more likely you are to be a habitual smoker of traditional cigarettes, which means that if, as is being reported, the Biden administration and congressional Democrats are trying to put this tobacco tax hike in the budget, you would have, by definition, be breaking the pledge made by President Biden not to increase taxes on people earning $400,000 a year or less, which then became households, $400,000. It doesn't matter if it's $4,000 a person household, if it's $40,000 a person, you're still going to be raising taxes on lower income people. That's going to be the net impact. Am I right about that?
You are right, because I mean, tobacco and cigarettes specifically is one of those few products that has an inverse relationship with income. So as income goes down, consumption goes up for cigarettes. So that means, you know, the less you make, the more likely you are to be a smoker. And this particular tax increase would fall heavily on those, you know, in the bottom quintiles of the income spectrum. I mean, if we look at, again, let's take New York as an example. If you're in the top income quintile, between the 80th and 100th percent, you would pay today 1% of your income in tobacco taxes if you smoke a pack of cigarettes today. That's compared to 16.6 if you're in the lower end of the income spectrum, 16 times as much of your income goes toward direct taxes. So another federal increase obviously would fall so much heavier on those making less than $400,000, $100,000, $50,000, $30,000, wherever you make the cutoff. Cigarette taxes are significantly more aggressive than any other excise tax out there.
So I guess my last question for you, Oryk, at the Tax Foundation is, if you know, one of the legislators who's considering this bill asked you about what it would do to the lives of the people in their district, and if they raise the issue of a society that is trying to, you know, change our attitude towards tobacco even more. I mean, when you've got the head of the world's biggest, I think Philip Morris is the biggest tobacco company, whatever they are, when he said in a speech, you know, I want to see a world free of cigarettes. Wow, you that's definitely a cultural sea change. What would you say to legislators about this legislation?
Well, I don't think that this Tobacco Tax Parity Act is the way to get there. As I mentioned earlier, I think encouraging consumption of less harmful products is a much better tool to move people away from cigarettes. I've often heard the argument that, you know, it's good that tobacco taxes fall more heavily on those making less money because that will further nudge them to quit. But we already have very high tax on cigarettes, and still the majority of smokers are in the lower income group. So I'm not sure that argument's really, it's really that valid. So for me, you want to spend more of the revenue that the states raise, that the federal government raises, on helping people quit. And you want to have affordable, less harmful products available to smokers who don't want to quit using nicotine, but who wants to get out of smoking cigarettes. I think those are really the two most important tools that the lawmakers have. Just adding more federal taxes on top and increasing taxes on those less harmful products will definitely be counterproductive.
Okay, that's all the common sense and reason I can take. We're going to throw you out of this. Oryk Bozin with the Tax Foundation, thanks so much for joining us. We really appreciate your time.
Thank you, Michael.
So I don't know about you, but I could use a cigar after that conversation. Smoke them if you got them, Drew Klein.
So you're going to meet me at Twins?
I'm ready to. Absolutely. I go right now. Like I want to know everyone to know that I share the love, because I go to Castro's in Bedford, Castro's in Manchester, go to Twins in Londonderry, go to Castro's in Concord.
Concord.
Yeah,
I just, and Federal Cigar.
Don't and Federal Cigars. Cigar. Yeah. In Plymouth. I love Federal Cigars out in Plymouth. I only get to smoke about one a week, but I try to spread the wealth. So it's a great, it really is just a cool thing about living in New Hampshire. And your comment earlier, Drew, about how Massachusetts created this culture is absolutely right. And there is a culture. Now you think about how many charity events do the cigar places that we know do. They do charity events all the time. They raise money for kids and schools, education, whatever. And they hire local people, their locally owned businesses. I thought those were good things, but I don't know.
Oh, you're a weirdo. That's why.
That's absolutely true. Well, thanks again, everyone, for listening to the New Hampshire Journal podcast. A reminder again, NHJ will be dark down next week. So don't panic. Don't panic. We'll be back the week after. Meanwhile, I'm leaving Drew Klein in charge. You can find his work at jbartlett.org. What other topics are on your mind these days, Drew?
Housing, big topic for us this summer, big topic for everybody. So we've done some research on that, and we've got some stuff that you can go look up if you're concerned about your home prices, you know, going so high that nobody can afford a home, and rental prices being so high you can't afford an apartment. You can go check out our work on that at jbartlett.org and sign up for our newsletter on our website as well.
The Broadside.
Which
I assume you'll be forced to change the name of at some point when the politically correct people start getting angry. So I'm gonna hang on to my Broadside memorabilia. I'll put it right next to my Cleveland Indians hat. We're at nhjournal.com. We're on Facebook. We're on Twitter. And of course, get the newsletter. You don't want to miss it. Thanks so much for listening to the podcast. I am Michael Graham.